arms races and doomsday devices.
People take, say, 50 H-bombs in the 100 megaton range and jacket them with cabal thorium G. When they are exploded, they will produce a doomsday shroud, a lethal cloud of radioactivity which will encircle the Earth for 93 years.
What a load of commie bull. I mean, after all.
No bull. Dr. Strangelove's bizarre 1960s scenario of nuclear destruction lives on in smaller conflict zones across the globe. Dancing with a nuclear Pandora, she speaks many languages. World of Warheads. It's no video game. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Friday, August 1st. It's the beginning of a new month. War of Warheads. We're talking about U.S. policy on countries with nukes, not necessarily created equal. New tensions between the U.S. and Pakistani spies. The CIA says it has proof some are double agents.
Apocalyptic. End of the world.
Thanks, Carrie, our senior producer. Children's books, are they giving kids newfound confidence? And the one-year anniversary of the I-35W bridge collapse in Minneapolis. Those stories in the day's news.
A relative is confirming reports that a government scientist linked to the deadly 2001 anthrax attacks has committed suicide. According to the Los Angeles Times, the Justice Department was about to file criminal charges against 62-year-old Bruce Ivins of Maryland. At least 20 people have died in a fire on board a passenger train in southern India. Authorities say it may have started from a wiring problem. Passengers pulled a chain to make the train stop once they realized there was a fire.
Today, Pakistan is angrily denying a New York Times report that its intelligence service helped plan a deadly bombing of India's embassy in Kabul last month. The denials come amid mounting allegations the secretive and very powerful agency is aiding Islamic militants. California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger yesterday announced drastic cost-cutting plans to deal with the state's $15.2 billion deficit.
Effective for the August payroll, tens of thousands of state employees will be paid the federal minimum wage until a budget is passed, and then, of course, they will get reimbursed the salary.
Schwarzenegger says also 10,000 others will be laid off. California lawmakers say the governor's drastic plans are a way of turning up the heat to force them to pass a budget.
In politics, John McCain and Barack Obama are in Florida today. McCain is addressing the National Urban League this morning. Barack Obama starts today with a town hall meeting in St. Petersburg. Oil is at $124 a barrel. This morning we're going to talk about what that means. The Dow lost more than 1.78% to close at 11,378 yesterday. The S&P opens at 1267.
I'm going to try this again.
Post-apocalyptic. Yes, maybe we need to talk about that.
And we are, because there are a new trend in children's books for the tween group, those 10 to 14. And the idea is that all the grown-ups are gone and the kids take control and they figure out how to keep humanity living.
It's actually a long-standing theme in children's literature, even though it is proliferating today. Go to see WALL-E if you want to see a post-apocalyptic movie. We want to know from you, what are your favorite post-apocalyptic children's stories? Reach us at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everybody. We begin with a little pre-apocalyptic news. We hear about nuclear policy in isolation virtually every day. Sit down now. We're going to learn you something about nuclear policy and all of its contradictions. Today, India is set to clear one of the last three hurdles to its historic nuclear deal with the United States. The International Atomic Energy Agency is expected to approve a mechanism to safeguard and inspect Indian nuclear facilities, lifting a 34-year-old ban on selling U.S. nuclear fuel and technology to India, even though Delhi has tested nuclear weapons and refuses to sign the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty. And tomorrow is also the deadline for Iran, which has signed the Nonproliferation Treaty, to agree to end its nuclear ambitions or else face more sanctions. So, are you keeping notes here? If you have nukes in India, we'll reward you with this cooperation agreement. But if you're Iran, we punish you. If you're North Korea, we scratch our heads. We're not sure exactly what to do there. Sharon Weinberger, veteran nuclear analyst and author of Nuclear Family Vacation, travels in the world of atomic weaponry. A bit of a multiple personality disorder going on here, don't you think, Sharon?
Well, this has long been the criticism of the administration going back for a few years now, that basically we treat countries differently depending on where they are on the political spectrum, where they are in relation to the United States. Pakistan in particular has been very critical of the U.S. deal with Iran, with India.
So, I mean, how are people to understand the fundamental differences between the supposed responsibility of India and the supposed irresponsibility of Iran?
A little bit of political expediency. I mean, one of the major accusations, a little bit of schizophrenia on the approach of the United States, where, you know, as you mentioned, we're rewarding a country that has not been a signatory to the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, which has had a nuclear weapons program, where Iran, on the other hand, which is a signatory to the treaty, although there have been accusations of secret nuclear work, it is a signatory to the treaty. Their argument is they are abiding by the treaty. They're working within the framework of the treaty. They have already IAEA inspectors, and they're in effect having punished, they face sanctions. And to the world, it's very, very hard because it sends a mixed signal. It says, you know, basically, you know, what can you do to kind of earn the good graces of the United States and the international community? It's not clear if you treat people differently.
Well, is there any way, using the current mechanisms of international governance, to come up with a policy that's going to be a sufficient umbrella for the likes of Israel, believed to be a nuclear power, India, Iran, Pakistan, and, you know, the European nations that are already nuclear?
Well, it comes down to sort of some of the fundamental problems that have come up in the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, that for starters being that not everyone is a signatory to it. But even those who are, such as Iran, you have a lot of ambiguities. You know, Iran's ongoing argument is that they have the right to enrich uranium. And the treaty is ambiguous on the degree to which you can enrich uranium, because once you master the technology to enrich uranium for nuclear power, you have the capability to enrich it for nuclear weapons. It's a matter of percentage, basically. You know, so one could argue that there's fundamental flaws in the current international framework, but if you aren't abiding by the current international framework, you can't come to agreements with countries under it. The idea that somehow you need a new framework is also a little bit flawed. One of the ongoing arguments as well for people is, you know, that we basically turned a blind eye to Israel's nuclear program, to their nuclear weapons program, which is not a declared nuclear power, but is presumed to have a reasonable stockpile.
And there's no even remote possibility of inspections in Israel based on the the internal Israeli policy and also U.S. politics.
Oh, no. In fact, it's very much a taboo subject. I was just speaking to a nuclear expert who was in Israel meeting with think tanks recently, and they said that, you know, even think tanks, you can't really have a discussion with them about the nuclear issue. I mean, it's acknowledged that Israel's a nuclear power, but it's a very, very secretive program, and it's just something that's not really talked about within Israel that much.
Well, perhaps, you know, what we need to do is reboot some broad global issue, some rethinking of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, just say never mind about what's gone on and just try to start afresh and move forward. I guess, is there any way of looking at this cooperation agreement with India as a net positive and possibly a model for other relationships going forward in the sort of the last question here?
Net positive for U.S.-Indian relations. I mean, you will, for the first time, if it goes through, you'll have IAEA inspectors in India, and that in itself is a good thing. It's not that everything is bad about it. It's a question of the message it sends to the world. I mean, the question we have going forward, and that you're starting to see in the presidential campaign, is the candidates start to define nuclear issues. I mean, what's been missing is sort of leadership from the United States, and what is our overall direction? Overall, what are we trying to achieve in nonproliferation? What would we like the world to look like when it comes to nuclear weapons? Mm. And you're just starting to see the debate on that.
A great subject for a presidential candidate speech, but one that we're not likely to see, but certainly something to hope for. Sharon Weinberger, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Sharon Weinberger is the author of Nuclear Family Vacation, Travels in the World of Atomic Weaponry. She's also a senior reporter for Wired.com, the Danger Room blog.
So much more on that story. I can only imagine we'll do lots of segments. But speaking of India and the proliferation agreement with the United States, that's something that's creating some tension for arch rival Pakistan. Also this week, a tough week for relationships between the CIA and Pakistan's very powerful inter-services intelligence. The CIA says it has hard evidence the ISI provided direct support for last month's deadly bombing of India's embassy in Kabul. The ISI denies it, and the situation has profound implications for the stability of the region. Just a very quick reminder, U.S. spies have been and continue to rely on the ISI for intelligence on tracking down Islamic militants and top al-Qaeda members. The ISI relies on tens of millions of dollars the U.S. sends, which it needs to keep up with the spy services of its arch rival, India. And joining us to sort through this is New York Times correspondent Eric Schmidt in Washington, D.C., who's been following the story very closely. Good morning, Eric.
Good morning.
I don't think we can really underscore just how powerful the ISI is in Pakistan, particularly in the last several of decades. What kind of evidence does the CIA says it has showing complicity with Islamic terrorists in Afghanistan?
Well, what U.S. intelligence agencies have now are communications intercepts between the ISI agents and the actual militants who carried out the bombing of the Indian embassy in Kabul on July 7th. And these intercepts demonstrate to the United States that the ISI agents were actively involved in the planning of the attack and have also helped these militants tip them off to intelligence in advance and help them avoid some airstrikes, apparently, by allied forces.
Now, anybody in the intelligence service wouldn't necessarily be shocked by these allegations. How did the Pakistani government respond?
Well, the Pakistanis have denied that there is any kind of relationship like this, a systematic relationship between members of their powerful spy agency and these militant groups. It's obviously been a very sensitive subject between the United States and Pakistan. As the New York Times reported just a couple of days ago, the number two official at the CIA was dispatched just a few weeks ago to Islamabad, the Pakistani capital, to confront Pakistan with information that the ISI had deepened its ties to these militants. It's a difficult relationship and one that the United States is still sorting through with its key ally, Pakistan.
It certainly has aggravated some tensions because the CIA really does rely on the ISI, and the ISI really does rely on the CIA. Can you describe the divided loyalties of the Pakistani intelligence service?
Well, you have, as you described, you have this system where the United States has relied on the ISI for much of the intelligence that it's getting out of these restive tribal areas that are right along the border with Afghanistan, where many of these militants have sought safe haven, including members of al-Qaeda. So the United States has relied on that. And yet ISI is also looking, at least some members of it apparently, looking to disrupt, possibly destabilize the governments in Afghanistan. And then, of course, as you alluded to, there is the long-time rivalry with India, and it's believed to run basically organizations and militant groups up in the Kashmir area there, where there have clearly been tensions for years between Pakistan and India.
But underlying this entire or this latest development is this ISI relationship with Islamic militants and the Taliban, which is longstanding, right?
That's right. They've had ties in with these militant groups, clearly during the Soviet era when Pakistan wanted to have intelligence inside of Afghanistan, and these groups were a key link to that and in the eyes and ears for the intelligence service of Pakistan, what was going on in its neighboring country.
Eric Schmidt, so much more to talk about this. Hopefully you'll come back and join us again sometime.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Eric Schmidt, reporter for The New York Times, reporting on the latest developments of the relationship between the Pakistani Secret Service and the CIA.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Actually, I mentioned Britney Spears is going to be with us later. That's
totally false.
But there is a huge celebrity in the studio, a huge celebrity in the studio right now. Just a moment, we're going to introduce him. I want to begin by just saying, you know, we're talking a little bit later in the show about post-apocalyptic children's literature. We wonder, in terms of you getting in touch with the conversation here at 877-8-MY-TAKE, how do you approach the subject with your kids? That's also a good story. We want to talk about favorite, you know, books that star kids where the adults are all gone. You know, you can begin with The Wizard of Oz if you like. It's a great theme, an interesting theme, particularly now. And if you saw the movie WALL-E, post-apocalypse is what that movie is all about. But we come back to the city of New York, and we want to set you right in the center of the action. And how does this feel?
New York is the cultural and financial capital of the world. A city of skyscrapers so dense, you can strain your neck marveling at their magnificence.
Tell me more, Tony.
An enormous bazaar of ideas and the best of everything that money can buy.
Everything?
A city of sprawling parks. A port city where the smell of the sea comes at you when you least expect it.
The smell, the feeling of New York, and much of the New York skyline erupted at the beginning of the 20th century. You can have that similar experience with probably a worse smell if you go to Beijing today and look at the air in that city, which is erupting in the beginning of the 21st century. Cranes everywhere, architectural monuments on every street corner. Kurt Anderson has just returned from Beijing and has a piece in this month's Vanity Fair all about the architectural monuments that are sprouting in Beijing here in the advance of the Olympics. Of course, Kurt Anderson, huge public radio celebrity, host and writer of PRI's Studio 360. Kurt, thanks for being with us.
Pleasure to be here.
So you walk the streets of Beijing and the monuments architecturally there, and I wanted you to talk specifically about the ones that really impressed you. And we have a slideshow on our website if you want to see them. Reminded you of the architectural monuments in New York of the 20th century.
Well, I took my notes and I realized that it reminded me of that more than anything else. There's also just the sheer size. I mean, the old historic core of Beijing, it's about the same size as Manhattan. The fully urbanized part is about the same size as all New York City. So I was looking at that, and then I suddenly thought, wait, where have we seen this before? This movie has run before. I've always been amazed that in such a brief period of time between 1900 and 1930, all of the icons of Manhattan, of New York City, essentially got built, from the New York Public Library to the Empire State Building. Rockefeller Center got started. Then as a sort of exclamation point to all that, the 1939 New York World's Fair. And that was at a time that America itself was just sort of emerging as a serious world power. The American century was starting, and I thought that's exactly what's happening here. And the buildings in Beijing are not just big and flashy and done by famous architects. Several of them are really great.
Well, you've got the Television Center, which is a Rem Koolhaas square Mobius strip in the middle of Beijing, an enormous office building.
Mobius? What does that mean?
It's kind of like a loop that is infinite. It's sort of a single-sided loop. If you can go to our website and see exactly what we mean. But it's a strange model for an architectural shape.
It's really unprecedented and looks different as you get closer from different angles in the city. I mean, most, you know, new buildings, even often, you know, iconic, great new buildings, you see them, you get them, okay, next. Whereas this is so interesting because you first see it on the Beijing skyline, and it's weird, and then you travel toward it and to
looks
different
like an
angles.
Arch. Looks like an arch, but
it looks
it's
like
not
an arch, and then you see it's not an arch, and then it looks because it operates in so many weird angles that's frankly very hard to describe. Better you should look at it in the pictures on the site. But it changes shape as you approach it in an extraordinary way. And then it is this loop. I mean, it's this 49-story tall loop with a top and a bottom and a top that sort of cantilevers out into space. And
it's an engineering marvel. I mean, when they connected the two sides, there was like a giant audience to watch it. They didn't think they would necessarily connect, but they did.
It was the day after Christmas last year, actually, right. Boxing Day, and of course they built it so that it didn't touch until you know, they would lean just enough toward each other in the building and then barely touch. It was like a NASA, you know, space docking maneuver.
Let's move on to a different building. Bird nests are not simply on the menu in Chinese restaurants anymore. They're a part of the skyline there in Beijing.
Yeah, and that's going to become, it is already becoming the icon of the Olympics, the Bird's Nest National Stadium, where the opening ceremonies are going to take place next Friday, the closing ceremonies 2 weeks later, and, you know, the big finals and the track events and stuff.
And the steel, the woven steel around that is really a monument not only to China and to the Olympics, but also to the high technology that allows you to even construct something like this today.
Well, exactly. And because, you know, it is amazing looking. It looks like something a very talented child would make. You know, not perfect, but and kind of irrational, but beautiful in its basket weaving sense. But it is, as you say, yeah, it's these, you know, 1 meter thick steel ribbons sort of wrapped up as if by a giant or God.
Can I ask you a little bit about your premise? I mean, the Gilded Age of New York was really a series of private sector icons who produced architectural monuments to themselves on the New York skyline. It seems to me that in some sense what's going on in Beijing is monuments to Chinese authority, and that there's not a kind of wildcat capitalist architectural building going on in Beijing, but much more of an institutional government, more like the Pentagon than Grand Central Terminal.
I would disagree. I think it's pretty wildcat-ish. You know, the CCTV building, and it's... Yes, it's the government television, state-run television, but once you start talking to people there, you realize it's not that simple. It's not like it's the government here, private sector here, and it's entirely distinct and binary. Everything is sort of, you know, or all these buildings anyway, is a little bit of both. So, and then this building, this complex by the American architect Steve Hall, is entirely private. It's these 12 buildings of movie theaters and hotels and apartments and gyms and a swimming pool 300 feet off the ground. Now, that's entirely private, but that developer is deeply, you know, connected to the regime. So I don't think you can draw those distinctions absolutely. And certainly in the case of New York, you know, the Brooklyn Bridge, the first great architectural icon, arguably, built in the 1880s, was a public infrastructure project.
Right. Well, walking the streets of Beijing, certainly very, very exciting. We're going to get to headlines in a moment, but I wanted to ask you just before we move to the next segment. You got a post-apocalyptic story that you loved as a child? Quickly?
If you're going to define The Wizard of Oz as post-apocalyptic, I don't remember post-apocalyptic stories other than that. Although
he was asleep. He was a child of the 60s. He was asleep during
Matilda,
the post-apocalypse.
Matilda.
Kurt Anderson, stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, now featuring Father's Day, a short film about a woman whose father left her when she was a child, and her daughter, who now wants to meet her estranged grandfather, if he lives long enough. Available at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everybody. We begin with headlines from Femi Okeh.
Thanks, John. 28 minutes to the hour. A government scientist and anthrax expert has committed suicide, according to the Los Angeles Times. Bruce Ivins was just about to be charged in connection with the deadly 2001 anthrax letter attacks. Rescuers in central Turkey are digging through the rubble of a girl's dormitory that collapsed today because of a gas explosion. Officials say they can hear voices underneath the debris. 13 people died and 27 have been injured. Relief agencies that work in Afghanistan say they may have to leave the country because of increasing violence. They say insurgent attacks are up 50% this year and at least 19 workers have been killed. Japanese Prime Minister Yasuo Fukuda has begun a reshuffle of his cabinet. He's replacing ministers in what's widely seen as an attempt to boost his low approval ratings. And historians in the UK have collected what they believe are the world's oldest jokes. They date back to 1900 BC. Now, Dr. Paul MacDonald from Wolverhampton University says that modern humour can be traced back to the very earliest gags, and they all share a willingness to deal with taboos and a degree of rebellion. Let me try this one out for you from Homer the Odyssey in 1800 BC. I've got a good audience because Kurt Anderson is still here. I know he'll laugh at this one. Odysseus Odysseus tells Cyclops that his real name is Nobody. So when Odysseus instructs his men to attack the Cyclops shouts, "Help! Nobody is attacking me!" No one comes to help.
Who's on first?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's 800 BC. It's a little old. A little dusty.
1800 BC. And, you know, I don't know if that was a joke, but I love that the Brits want to find the oldest jokes in the world.
They scoured history for
humor.
Them.
Yes, right.
The top one is not repeatable.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much.
Okay. As Femi said, writer and host of PRI Studio 360, Kurt Anderson, is still with us. And we're going to turn to books right now. The Wizard of Oz, Lord of the Rings, and Lord of the Flies. What do they have in common, Kurt?
They've sold many, many millions of copies, and the fate of the world is either at stake or already decided in the negative.
You got it, a troubled world that kids, you forgot a key component there, are trying to navigate, even saving. But there's a new trend popping up in children's book or books for young people, post-apocalyptic worlds where few individuals have survived and kids find themselves in a destroyed world where they have to band together to rebuild. Joining the takeaway is Susan Pfeffer, who's in the midst of the trend with two books on the shelf, Life as We Knew It, and The Dead and the Gone. We're also joined by child psychologist Dr. Frank Gaskill to give us some perspective on a child's mind. Susan, good morning.
Good morning.
Let's start with you. Tell us about Life as We Knew It. It sounds pretty ominous for your main character, Miranda.
Things are not good for Miranda in the book, nor are they good for Alex in The Dead and the Gone. Basically, there has been an astronomical effect where the moon has been nudged a little bit closer to Earth, which causes great changes in the moon's gravitational pull on the Earth. And one bad thing leads to another. Disaster followed by disaster.
And we certainly don't want to give away any of the specifics of the book, but in general, Miranda and your other character in The Dead and the Gone, they both find themselves in a situation where there are no adults, right?
No. Miranda lives with her mother and two brothers, one older, one younger. Alex's parents in The Dead and the Gone are missing, so he has more responsibility.
And what kinds of obstacles are these young people facing?
Lack of food, the collapse of the food chain, horrific weather conditions, the loss of people that they love, the death of people that they love, lack of heating, the end of oil heating up furnaces, transportation ends because there's no gas for the cars.
Very serious and scary situations.
That's the idea.
Because?
Because it makes for a better story.
Dr. Gaskill, how do you think children and these books, Susan, they're really for 10 to 14-year-olds, right?
Or older.
Older, or 10 and up, we should say.
Yeah, I would go 12 and up or 11 and up.
12 and up. These are very serious issues.
Well, they are and they aren't. I think I have not read her books, but I'm intrigued to read them now. It doesn't sound any different from the books that you are already describing, Lord of the Rings, but then you have Orson Scott Card's Ender's Game. There's a Hungry City series. All of these books are exciting, and it's in a great setting, and it reels in the young reader.
Well, Ender's Game is a great book where a kid saves the galaxy, and really it's all about wanting the adults to be gone. Why do kids want the adults to be gone? I have two 10-year-olds. They're happy when I'm out of the house.
Well, it's part of individuation, independence, practicing being on their own, and the way this book is described sounds like it also gives kids another opportunity to practice their independence before they really are.
And this, well, there's two lessons here, really, right? One is that kids have more power, perhaps, than they think they do, right?
True.
And is that something that is automatically realized? Like, is that theme obvious, Susan, say, in your two books?
They learn their strengths. Each book is about 300 pages of learning their strengths. But yes, by the end of the books, both characters realize how much more capable they are and how deep their love for their family is.
And Dr. Gaskill, is that an important lesson to learn in the face of very real and serious challenges that we face as a nation and a world, given concerns about global climate changes, given concerns about terrorism, and so on and so forth?
It is. And if the conclusion of the story is how important family is, that's fantastic. But even the role of these books, the role of video games, the role of various graphic novels that are out there, my hope is that families would be reading right along with kids and talking with them about what they're learning.
What if they're not, though?
Well, I don't see that's necessarily a downside, unless there's some particular issues going on with a particular individual, but those are rare. And the book itself, or the books, the topics themselves, is not what the problem is. The problem is typically something that's going on within the family itself.
But is there an age at which it's too young to suggest to a little kid that, hey, by the way, the whole world could implode and everything you know could be blown away tomorrow? Is that a sort of appropriate notion to bring to kids' minds?
Well, when I was growing up, I'm 39, so I would imagine probably ages 10 would be a little scary at that point.
Yeah, you want to at least be able to read before you. Frank, we're going to hold on for a second. Dr. Frank Gaskill, child psychologist in Charlotte, North Carolina. We'll be back to you in a minute. And Susan Pfeffer is also on the line. She writes children's books on this subject, Life as We Knew It, The
Please
Dead and
stay
Gone.
With
stay
us.
With us. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji.
It was 1 year ago today that the I-35W bridge collapsed suddenly during rush hour in Minneapolis. I remember it because I had tickets to a police concert at Madison Square Garden. I was waiting at a bar for my wife to show up so we could go to the concert when the news reports flashed on the TV.
We're following a very serious story right now. Just a few moments ago, we found out there was a bridge collapse in Minneapolis.
I remember grabbing for my cell phone because my sister lives in the Twin Cities, and she takes that bridge from home to work every single day. I tried to call, but the lines were all busy.
We do not want to encourage people to go down there and call their friends and tell them what they see on the cell phones, because they need those cell lines open. They need communication to be open for people.
The unfolding details were grisly and sad. This eyewitness was actually driving on the bridge when it collapsed.
Well, it was bumper to bumper traffic. We're probably going 10 miles an hour. There was a lot of cars on that bridge. And I was on the side looking forward. I was on the shore looking forward to the rest of the bridge, and I saw all the rest of the cars fall as I was falling, and then the dust it was just unbelievable. It starts shaking in complete free fall, and I'm lucky to be alive.
Fortunately, my sister was just fine, and mine was one of the many hundreds of thousands of sighs of relief that day. But 13 people were not so lucky, and it took weeks, 20 days specifically, to recover all the bodies trapped underneath the rubble of that bridge in the murky Mississippi River.
The safety board is concerned that, for at least this bridge, there was a breakdown in the design review procedures that allowed a serious design error to be incorporated into the construction of the I-35W bridge.
That's Mark Rosinger of the National Transportation Safety Board. The design flaw was large pieces of support steel called gusset plates. They were undersized and inadequate to handle the large load of the bridge. The rest of the nation suddenly took a look at their own bridges and highways in their own communities. Kentucky Congressman John Yarmuth had these words for the Democrats' weekly radio address last April.
Across America, our roads and bridges are crumbling and are in desperate need of repair. Yet taxpayer dollars are being squandered on an Iraqi government that is riddled with waste, fraud, and corruption.
In Minneapolis, the rebuilding began. The Minnesota Department of Transportation fast-tracked a new bridge in hopes of getting the project done on Christmas Eve of this year. They might make it. A compensation package for victims was announced in May. Survivor Kimberly Brown was one of the beneficiaries.
For everything that the families have been going through, and everybody who was injured, whose lives have been completely changed, I'm just very hopeful for them that they can move on from this now.
But for the rest of the nation, the bridge tragedy soon faded in importance and visibility. An Associated Press review of each state's most frequented bridges shows that only 12% have deficiencies that have ever been fixed. Minneapolis Mayor R.T. Ryback has these words for other communities in an interview with WCCO-TV.
I'm really pretty stunned how quickly people stop asking the big questions about why this happened, and how easily people think about this being something that, you know, just happened.
Bridges across the country aren't in danger of collapsing, but one in four need upgrading, and it could take $140 billion to fix them. A year later, residents of Minneapolis will be honoring those affected by the collapse with a moment of silence. And in a creepy twist that I just realized as we were doing this story yesterday, I actually have tickets to a Police concert tonight in Saratoga in upstate New York. We here at The Takeaway would like to pay our respects to those affected by the Minneapolis tragedy, and we hope you have a safe drive to wherever you're headed this morning.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of home, auto, and life insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Friday. It's August 1st, and we're just going to continue a conversation we've been having about post-apocalyptic books, a new trend for children, where these kids find themselves in a destroyed world and they're having to band together to rebuild. Still with us is writer and host of PRI Studio 360, Kurt Anderson. Also, Susan Pfeffer, who's written two of these books, Life as We Knew It in 2006 and The Dead and the Gone, that just came out this year in 2008. And also Dr. Frank Gaskill, a child psychologist in Charlotte, North Carolina. Thanks, all of you, for staying with us. And Susan, what inspired you to write books with characters, children, facing just all kinds of major grown-up kinds of issues like global climate change and destroyed societies?
Well, to some extent, what inspired me was what you've been talking about on the radio this morning. You had a news item about anthrax, a news item about a girl's dormitory blowing up, a news item about relief workers being killed while trying to do their jobs in Afghanistan, and a news item about a follow-up on a bridge collapse. Disaster is all around us. And kids are very, very aware of it. And I just wanted to put kids in a situation where they were an active part of the survival in a very dangerous and unexpected world.
Frank, you know, kids in that world that Susan writes about so, you know, so vividly love to be in situations, whether it's post-apocalyptic or not, where they rely on themselves and kind of trick the world of circumstances into winning. And I think that, you know, that's a theme that's pretty deep for young kids.
Well, and I think that's why I'm loving the sound of these books. It's the same as video games. It's putting kids in a place that is relatively healthy, that they can practice control, practice being the boss and saving the world. It's the X-Men, Batman, Maximum Ride. It's letting them play out in their minds how to master uncontrollable situations.
Which, ironically, those movies you just mentioned from the Marvel Comics series, they're all hitting it huge in the movie world for both young people and adults this summer.
Right.
Well, and there's a whole apocalyptic sort of subcategory of adult art and entertainment that is very much in vogue right now. Cormac McCarthy's book, The Road, Children of Men.
No Country for Old Men.
Not for kids, though.
I'm saying this.
No Country for Old Men, the kids' story. Yeah, right. Yeah.
But it's a little parallel. It's a parallel cultural trend, is what you're saying, Kurt.
Exactly. And I'm also interested. I remember as a kid reading Huckleberry Finn and feeling, yeah, Huck and Tom, and they're, you know, in charge of their own world in this really empowered way. And then the next year, reading Lord of the Flies and really disturbed, finding that truly disturbing in what I think ultimately was a good way, and it didn't turn me into a killer. But
not yet. It's early yet.
Well, I was about to say, and you had the final word there, Kurt Anderson, writer and host of PRI Studio 360. We thank you. Susan Pfeffer, we wish you all the best with your books.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us. And Dr. Frank Gaskill, child psychologist in Charlotte, North Carolina. Thanks for joining us. And Susan Pfeffer's books are Life as We Knew It and The Dead and the Gone.
I think we found the one child psychologist who is pro-video games in the entire universe.
He said there's certainly a lesson in there. Well, actually, maybe we'll have Dr. Gaskill come back and explain exactly why he thinks that's such a good idea. But right now, we're going to get some headlines from Femi. Okay, Femi?
Hello there. Coming up to 8 minutes to the hour, the UN Security Council has approved another year of peacekeeping in Darfur, just hours before the mandate expired. The U.S. abstained from the vote. It objects to the African Union's questioning the indictment of Sudanese President al-Bashir. In Montana, fire crews are warning residents near Billings to get ready to evacuate again. A wildfire is threatening their homes and a nearby ski resort. California is facing a more than $15 billion deficit, and Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger says that the budget crisis is forcing him to lay off 22,000 state workers and cut wages for 200,000 others. And that's all my post-apocalyptic news
for
now.
Thank you, Femi.
That's a tough word.
I'm still thinking about the little country for old men. Or what about megatubbies? You could do, instead of teletubbies, give me megaton tubbies or something. You know,
who destroy the world and kids need to band together. Anyhow,
well, we can shift gears here. You know, if you're married or if you're living together, I mean, some people don't need a marriage license to hook up. No way, man. That's bad girl Joni Mitchell singing about cohabitation, which eventually became a subject for a cheesy sitcom by the 1980s. Come and knock on our door. Come and knock on our door. Three's Company, Janet, Chrissy, and Jack. Still a tiny bit dangerous in the 1980s, but by the 2006 movie Breakup, cohabitation is all about counting lemons.
What my baby wants, my baby gets.
No, but I wanted 12. Baby wanted 12.
Why do you want 12?
Because I'm making a 12-lemon centerpiece.
So no one's even going to eat the lemons? You're suggesting to me that these are just show lemons?
New data from the Census Bureau, that's from the movie Breakup, Vince Vaughn and Jennifer Aniston, who live together in a, you know, in wacky hijinks in the Hollywood movie. But the Census Bureau shows, according to data released this week, that 1 in 10 opposite-sex couples living together are unmarried. And this isn't necessarily like a precursor to marriage. It's an enormous jump in the number of people who are cohabitating and thinking that it's absolutely no big deal, which motivated us to call our friend James Burnett, who's the pop culture and urban living writer for the Miami Herald. He's also author of the Burnetticut blog, and he joins us from the studios of WLRN Public Radio for South Florida. James, you took this data really deep into your own personal life and decided to explore cohabitation from the James Burnett perspective.
Good morning, John.
Good morning, James.
I had to take it personally, you know, with a little bit of humor, of course. My father's a preacher, and my mother, the preacher's wife. And I recall with a little bit, seriously, like from the movies, but, I recall with a little bit of humor a few years ago before my wife and I got married. I swear I'm only half joking when I say that my folks would have prayed down a plague on us had we moved in together prior to marriage.
So what changed?
You know, we had sleep. Well, nothing changed.
I see. So they're a little worried about the whole thing. I see.
Well, they were. We're married now, you know, have been for 3 years. But prior to that, you know, they I really think they might have tried something like that. But it was their old moral standards. It was their old religious standards, neither of which I hold against them or anybody else. Of course, they're my folks. But I noticed that people from my generation just have a completely different take on it.
Well, you say it's a financial strategy issue way more than a moral issue. Explain.
Now it is. Absolutely. You know, the best way to get feedback on stories like this is to consult people who are doing it. So I went to my friends, my peers. People in their early to mid-30s who are not married yet, and every last one of them who are couples who are living together said that they're doing this to save money, to share the bills, share the cable bills, share the utilities, so on and so forth. And if in the long run the relationship doesn't work, they're okay with that because along the way they saved a few bucks.
There's really two interesting aspects I thought about this. One is that this is the first time the Census Bureau ever specifically asked that question to people, whether or not they were cohabitating with something. In 2007, interesting note. Second of all is USA Today did an interesting poll, and they found that half of the people they polled thought living together makes it less likely that you're going to divorce. So not only is there perhaps some monetary issue at hand, but also this sense that this is good for building relationships.
It's practice.
Out of time
absolutely.
Tryouts.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny. Several academic studies back up the USA Today poll from the University of Wisconsin, Western Washington University, Cornell, Penn State. One of those studies said that 28 people who cohabitate with their eventual spouse are 28% less likely to get divorced later.
And that's,
than those who wait.
That's different from what it was 20, 30 years ago, where probably a much smaller group of people were living together before they get married and maybe were more like, you know, Sid
heathens.
And Nancy from, you know, the heathens. Sex Pistols or
heathens
something.
Heathens comes, comes yeah. to mind, right?
Right.
James,
yes,
heathens.
Absolute heathens, you know, hellfire and brimstone. Heathens who were not considering, again, the financial aspect or anything else. It was just, you know, I can't do this because my neighbors, my relatives will frown on me. And, you know, I even put this out there on my blog. And overwhelmingly, readers said that you have to live with your eventual spouse before you get married because you have to test the waters.
Well, Burneticut dude, James, I wish we had more time to talk about this. You are the author of the Burneticut blog, a pop culture and urban living writer for the Miami Herald, James Burnett.
Yes,
because,
I am.
You know, one of the great details in your blog, we can't talk about it, is that you use your pad as the getaway from her space and you live together in her place. That's a whole other subject. James, thanks for being with us.
No worries.
All right, we're always on at The Takeaway. You can catch up with us on Facebook and Friend Feed.
And today marks the one-year anniversary of the tragic Minnesota bridge collapse. And we're also talking about cohabitation. Numbers go through the roof.
Today's Takeaway.
Things are not good for Miranda.
That was Susan Pfeffer, who writes children's book, the author of Life as We Knew It and The Dead and the Gone.
What are your favorite post-apocalyptic kid stories? 877-8-MY-TAKE. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji. This is The Takeaway.
Oh, my God, oh, my God. If my parents gave me the name Wolfgang, I would probably prefer to go by my middle name. The musical influences of Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart are deep and wide in world culture. Where does the child prodigy, musical genius, artist, and cultural insurgent fit in our culture today? We're mostly Mozart on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning on this Friday, August 1st. We're mostly Mozart, but we're also taking a look at Congress as it finishes up its session to get to its summer break. What are they leaving behind? Turkey, new developments on the tensions between the Islamic ruling party and rival secularists. And North Dakota, there's black gold in them prairies, bubbling crude, and oil rush is on. That story and all the day's news.
An Army scientist who reportedly committed suicide on Tuesday was being linked to the deadly anthrax mailings of 2001. According to a military report, just after the attacks, Bruce Ivins was accused of conducting unauthorized testing for anthrax spores outside of designated areas. The LA Times reports Ivins was about to be charged by the Justice Department. At least 20 people have died in a fire on board a passenger train in southern India. Authorities say it may have started from a wiring problem. Passengers pulled a chain to make the train stop once they realized there was a fire.
100 aid agencies in Afghanistan are warning they may have to pull out of the country due to increasing violence. They cite a 50% increase in insurgent attacks compared to the previous year, many of which are targeting at aid agencies. Pakistan is angrily denying a New York Times report that its intelligence service helped plan a deadly bombing of India's embassy in Kabul last month. The denials come amid mounting allegations that the secretive agency is aiding Islamic militants.
California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger yesterday announced drastic cost-cutting plans to deal with the state's $15.2 billion deficit.
Effective for the August payroll, tens of thousands of state employees will be paid the federal minimum wage until a budget is passed, and then, of course, they will get reimbursed the salary.
Schwarzenegger also says 10,000 others will be laid off. Flags are flying at half-staff today at the state capitol in Minnesota as the 13 victims of last year's bridge collapse are being remembered. Memorial services are planned throughout the day.
This just breaking coming across the Associated Press. General Motors is reporting a $15.5 billion second quarter loss as strikes, restructuring, and restructuring costs have driven down earnings. Big number there, John.
Different color on the balance sheet than Exxon reported yesterday. The Dow lost more than 1.78% yesterday. The S&P begins trading at 1267. What will the markets do with that GM information? We're talking about Mozart this hour, though.
We are. Amadeus.
He's one of the most annoying people who's ever lived. I mean, by the time he was 10, he'd written a symphony. By the time he was 13, a couple of operas. But where does the child prodigy live today? Who is the Mozart of the 21st century in your life? Tell us. Who does it all?
Who writes the music? Who composes the symphony? Who perhaps gets on the stage on Broadway, gets in movies? I'm thinking Mos Def.
Stevie Wonder is a musical genius, said Eddie Murphy one time. Who's your musical genius on the Mozart scale? 877-8-MY-TAKE.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everybody. It is August 1st. It's, of course, August 1st all over the world, but in Washington, D.C., and especially on Capitol Hill, these are the dog days, the benign, lazy sort of dog days where it's really hot and lawmakers in the middle of an election campaign don't do that much. It's kind of benign, kind of sleepy, but lurking out there just offshore is a bickering fight between the Democrats and Republicans over offshore drilling, and it could just mean the shutdown of the government. Joining us now is Todd Zwillick, our Capitol Hill correspondent, reporter, anchor for Capitol News Connection. Todd, what's going on down there?
So dramatic. Can't you sense our drama this morning, Todd?
I love that intro.
Go, baby.
Yeah, well, a looming shutdown. Some of us on Capitol Hill have been saying that the debate over oil could go nuclear. And I know that's really cute, but there is a possibility that this could happen. They've been arguing over offshore drilling and oil policy for the better part of 2 months, and most people know that. And some people probably know that they're leaving today for the August recess in both the House and the Senate, having basically accomplished nothing. So flash forward to when they come back in September. This problem still looms out there. The Republicans are dug in. They want new offshore drilling, and the Democrats do not want new offshore drilling. They're in favor of some, but not new.
Well, Todd, let's listen to some of the voices in this debate. Here's Representative Dan Burton of Indiana, Republican, talking about, you know, the confrontation that's looming in precisely the words that you've used.
I was there when we shut down the government. That was based on a spending issue, totally spending. And Newt Gingrich said, if we're going to control spending, we have to shut the government down. We have to be firm. That backfired. And Newt got a lot of flack, and so did all of us. But this is a different issue. We're talking about people paying $4 or $5 for a gallon of gas.
The stakes are higher, just like the energy prices. Here's Senator Jim DeMint of South Carolina.
This is very different than 95. I think the American people, the overwhelming majority of American people, would want Republicans to stand against any ban on drilling. And I think it would backfire on the Democrats if they try to threaten a government shutdown so they can have a ban on drilling. I don't see any way that could play in their favor. But they're so overconfident, they probably believe it can.
Todd, it sounds like the Republicans are going to hold fast here if the Democrats try to keep offshore drilling off the table.
Well, we will see. It's a good thing to say now heading into the August recess and rallying the troops and, you know, sounding all the notes that we are not going to back down and we should go to the mat on this. Whether or not they do it, we'll see. This is all going to be part of a debate over what's called a CR. That's a continuing resolution. It's going to be a funding bill for the government. The reason offshore drilling is banned, John, is because every year the ban is slipped into an appropriations bill, into these spending bills. Well, Republicans are saying, we should not, none of us, not the president, not one single Republican member of Congress should support the spending bill in September if it's got that ban in there. If they succeed in blocking it, if they go to the mat on this, so to speak, without a spending bill, there's no government funding. Without any government funding, there's a shutdown. If they'll do it, we'll see. That's going to depend if people feel like it's in their favor to go to the limit.
Let's talk about the practicality, though, of that argument. It is very tricky, isn't it? Because no one, especially not the Republicans, economists can't even agree, have this notion that there is a direct link between the gas prices and offshore drilling. People seem to be saying, experts in the field, that even if the ban were lifted, you're not talking about seeing any actual oil making it to any gas stations for upwards of 10 years or more.
Right. Well, a lot of this, you're onto something very important, because a lot of this is going to depend on Republicans polling and on Democratic polling and what they're learning from what voters actually think about this debate, not necessarily what it will really do, unfortunately, the policy, but what people think. If right now Republicans think they're winning the argument on drilling, that many Americans want drilling, well, Democrats say that their polls show that Americans don't blame high gas prices on the fact that there's no offshore drilling, that there's a lot of factors like oil companies, foreign governments, profit taking, and that offshore drilling is way down the list. If that moves up and people really do blame it on the fact that there's no drilling, then Republicans might see some impetus to go forward with this.
This is fascinating, Todd, because it means that the fate of the government is in the hands of people that Republican lawmakers are going to be talking to over the next month as they travel at their Rotary Club meetings and their breakfasts and their campaign events and take the temperature of people on this issue of drilling. If they come back to Washington believing that it's on their side, it's an issue they can win on, we may be in for a showdown.
It's absolutely possible. It depends on people that Democrats talk to, too. Imagine that. The fate of the government is actually in the hands of people that lawmakers talk to.
Hold the presses, Todd. We got to go. Thanks so much. Todd Zwillick, reporter anchor for Capital News Connection.
We're going to move on to Turkey, where at least one bit of the debate between secularists and the Islamic ruling party has come to a close, or at least seemingly so. The Supreme Court, the highest court in the country there, ruled this week against the secularists, who were alleging that the Islamically ruled government had injected religion into a country that is founded on the separation of religion and state. The AK party was on trial for alleged anti-secular activities, but the court didn't buy it. The 11 justices could not agree that that indeed was the case. We're joined on the line for the very latest on what this means for Turkey at a very interesting time by BBC correspondent Sarah Rainsford in Istanbul. Thank you so much for being with us, Sarah.
Hi, hello.
How has this played out, the decision by the Supreme Court?
Well, it's seen in Turkey as probably the best decision for all sides. It's coming amid, or hopefully ending, people here think, months of political crisis, a crisis that's pitted staunch secularists here, the establishment that includes the military and parts of the judiciary, against the government, which is rooted in political Islam. And for months, the country's slipped from one part of that political crisis to another until we've had this trial. As you say, the government was on trial, alleged it was accused of trying to bring religion into politics, undermining the secular system here. In the end, what the judges have done is, rather than close the party down, as the prosecutor had been asking, a majority of them have ruled that the party is anti-secular, that it is guilty, but that it won't be closed, that they've opted basically to send what they called a serious warning to the party, that they're watching them very closely, but that they've not closed the party down. Instead, they've slashed treasury funding to the party. They've given them financial sanctions, but they haven't taken the ultimate step of closing the party down.
And this issue obviously has triggered tremendous amount of passions, and people feel very, very strongly. Where does this leave the secularists who really believe that their country is heading in the wrong direction? And this comes in the midst, we should mention, of the alleged coup plot that law enforcement officials there say they've rounded up many people who were involved in trying to overthrow that Islamic ruling party who's governing now.
That's right. A separate plot, but one that's been unfolding or being revealed at the same time as this trial was going on. So staunch secularists, ultra-nationalists, who joined forces allegedly to try to overthrow the government. 86 suspects are now on trial, will be on trial for that. There are 86 suspects in that case. The trial will begin in October. The staunch secularists are seeing this as a victory for them, although the party hasn't been closed down. Secular Turks, the opposition party here, do believe that the AKP has been found guilty. That's the way that they're playing this. They're saying that, in fact, 6 out of the 11 judges did vote for party closure. That's a majority. But it's one short, of course, of the number required by the Constitution to close a party. So,
but Sarah, there is a cautionary note here, though. As the secularists declare a certain kind of victory, I mean, one could certainly argue that this amounts to a kind of de facto amending of the Constitution by not really dealing with this issue. Essentially, they've tolerated a level of Islamic involvement in government that is explicitly permitted or explicitly forbidden by the Turkish Constitution.
Well, what they've done is said that there are concerns, but it's not enough according to the very strict requirements of the Constitution for a party closure. So they've kept to the letter of the Constitution, absolutely, in the sense that 7 judges didn't find that the party was guilty enough in order to be closed down. But what they've done, as I say, is sent a warning saying that there are problems within the party and that that's why this court case was brought, and that therefore the party would have to make some compromises. And in fact, the whole discussion since then has now revolved around the consensus required now in Turkish politics, the fact that people believe that the ruling AK Party, which got 47% at the last election, will have to accept that it can't always rule by saying, look, we're the most popular party in the land, we'll do what we want, that there are certain issues in this country they must be very careful on, otherwise they could wind up back in court.
Sarah Rainsford, many thanks for the update. Sarah Rainsford reports for the BBC, and she came to us from Istanbul, Turkey.
You know, the next phase in this is what the party does to change, and that's really
or not.
All Turkish.
Or not, because there's a level of permissibility, exactly. As you noted.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everybody. So imagine if in your little town, someone called a meeting to say that there were untold riches waiting to be found beneath your feet.
Ladies and gentlemen, if I say I'm an oil man, you will agree. Now, you have a great chance here. Out of all men that beg for a chance to drill your lodge, maybe 1 in 20 will be oil men. The rest will be speculators. That's men trying to get between you and the oil men to get some of the money that ought by rights come to you.
Like the movie There Will Be Blood, there's an oil boom these days in North Dakota. And people there don't need a lot of convincing at these fuel prices to start drilling. Climbing oil prices and developing drilling technology are just a few factors in this new boom. More and more people are trying to get into the action. The state is becoming home to millionaires because of the wealth underneath the ground. It's a great motivation for a filmmaker like Caitlin McNally, who's in the middle of documenting this 21st century oil boom. Caitlin, you know, you've got a work in progress to share with us, and we definitely want to follow you through your discoveries of what's going on in North Dakota, but you've brought some of what you've already discovered in this modern There Will Be Blood. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me, John.
Now, you know, Daniel Day-Lewis tees up the fact in the movie the wealth of oil brings all kinds of characters to these small towns, and you've discovered something of the same thing.
I have, absolutely. It's very fascinating to see the different types of characters that are brought together around an oil boom. You have so many jobs created by the sheer fact that that there's all this oil activity in the area. So you've got people moving in from around the country. I met 2 young girls at a cafe in a tiny town in rural North Dakota.
Trisha and Lily?
Yep.
Let's hear their voices.
I'm Trisha Bracken. I'm from Albany, New York.
My name's Lily Duff, and I'm from Olympia, Washington. Our boyfriends work in oil field, and that's what brought us here. Money.
Kind of says it all.
Yep, that's it. That's the honest truth. They followed their boyfriends, one from the West Coast, one from the East Coast, followed their boyfriends to North Dakota. And one of the things that I talked to them about, and they were very, very honest about, was kind of the shock of moving to this very barren, very empty part of the country. And but there's enough money to be made. You know, the average income in North Dakota is something like $35,000 a year. Mm. The average income working in the oil fields is $70,000 a year. It's a huge economic opportunity for people from around the country. So you're seeing all these new faces in tiny towns that were losing population pretty much up until now.
But the workers are really the least of it. I mean, obviously, this investigation is being driven by oil companies, or, I mean, who's going to actually set up the system to get the oil?
Well, it takes a big effort on the part of a lot of people to get all this oil out from under the ground. A drilling rig can have anywhere from 20 to 50 people who are working on the rig. You know, obviously, the oil companies are bringing in tons and tons of drilling rigs, and these are transient workers who follow a rig. So it's people that could have been in Russia the month before mm-hmm. and might be in Alaska next month. But right now, they're in North Dakota also following this boom. Another
thing
that happens,
coordinating this effort are independents who basically mobilize the capital and get the workers in place. Here's one North Dakota native, Tom Ritter, who is an oil independent, kind of a modern day wildcatter who's sitting in the middle of this vortex here.
Just of late, this Bakken formation that's come on is a huge discovery for this basin. North Dakota's been hot and then not. And now they're hot again. This is probably one of the biggest discoveries in 30 years.
The Bakken Formation is this geological formation beneath which is a lot of oil, like Spindletop, a formation that created the wealth of Houston, Texas.
Mm-hmm.
People are pretty excited, it sounds
like. Oh, they're very, very excited. You know, I've had this, Bakken is a magic word there. I've had the Bakken described to me as a big Oreo cookie. It's a rock formation 2 miles underground, very tough to get to, but now because of high oil prices and advances in technology, it's possible to get to all the wealth that this rock formation holds. You see bumper stickers now that the state of North Dakota has put out that says "Rockin' the Bakken." There's really palpable excitement. I had one veteran oil man who's been in the North Dakota oil business since it began in the 1950s say to me very earnestly, "This is like Christmas Eve. Hmm. We've been waiting for this moment to finally get this oil out of the ground that we knew was there."
And some of the Indian reservation, the officials from the Indian reservation have been saying, "We knew this all along."
Areas that were never developed in the past are going to be. The tribal members have been really patient. They knew the oil was there, they knew the gas was there, but getting to the opportunity to benefit from their minerals, it was a long time coming.
One of the narratives you discovered in that sort of encounter with the Indians at Fort Berthold are a cautionary tale about, are they going to be exploited? Concerns about competition over the resource, and then ultimately, which you haven't really investigated yet but is probably looming in the film, is notions of environmental problems, worker problems, and this could be fool's gold in the end.
I think there's always that risk that people are aware of. A lot of people did tell me, people in towns, people on the street in North Dakota would tell me, a boom is almost always followed by a bust. And they're aware of this. Everyone's aware of that fact, that there, that there could be another side of this that doesn't look as rosy as everything looks there right now. But one thing, you hear people talk about what's going on in North Dakota. You hear people talk about North Dakota as the underground rock star of the oil industry right now. And it really is kind of, it's been a pretty quiet growth up until now. So there hasn't been a ton of environmental pushback that we've heard about yet. This isn't as kind of high profile as the California coast or parts of Alaska. It's all happened kind of under the radar up until now. So it remains to be seen what kind of pushback we're going to start seeing.
And your cameras will be there. There will be something. There will be more pictures from Caitlin McNally, independent documentary producer, who's got a great window on a piece of America that's unfolding in North Dakota. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having
me. Thanks, Caitlin. Now we're going to get some headlines from Femi. Okay, Femi.
It is just coming up to 29 minutes past the hour. The New York Times says that the U.S. government has proof that Pakistani intelligence services helped plan the deadly attack on the Indian embassy in Kabul earlier this month. Pakistan is angrily denying any connection with the bombing that killed 54 people. A government scientist and anthrax expert has committed suicide, just as charges were about to be filed against him in connection with the 2001 anthrax attacks. 62-year-old Bruce Ivins worked at a Maryland biodefense lab for 18 years, and he died of a drug overdose. General Motors has posted a $15.5 billion loss in the second quarter. That's the third largest quarterly loss in the company's history. The auto giant is chalking up some of those losses to the plummeting sales of trucks and SUVs. And that's a look at some of your international and domestic headlines for now.
So that loss was a record. That's very, very sad.
$15 billion. Wow, it's just hard to believe it wouldn't be.
I misplaced a billion once. anyway, there's video from Caitlin McNally's oil video on our website.
The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, now featuring Father's Day, a short film about a woman whose father left her when she was a child, and her daughter, who now wants to meet her estranged grandfather, if he lives long enough. Available at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning on this Friday, August 1st. And something might have come to mind when you saw the calendar turn over to August, and that is we are exactly 1 week away from the beginning of the Beijing Olympics. And today, a 5.8 magnitude earthquake hit southwest China's Sichuan province, the site of the May 12th deadly earthquake. Joining us for more about that and Beijing's readiness for the Olympics next week is the BBC's correspondent, Carrie Grace, who is currently in Chengdu. Good morning.
Good morning. Yes, we felt that aftershock here in the provincial capital and in the worst earthquake hit areas. People are terrified of the aftershocks. They still have tents up. Many people still living in tents, but even those who are in solid structures have tents so they can run out, get into the tents when they feel the aftershocks. We were in an orphanage, for example, the day before yesterday, and all the children come out of the main building, go into the tents as soon as the aftershocks begin. So this is an area which is still very traumatized, where people are still very anxious, and where people are living in very miserable conditions, some of them. There are 5 million people still living in tents, leaking in the rain, very hot in the sun, hoping they can get into proper housing before winter.
Carrie Gracie, and please excuse me for that misstatement, but you can only imagine that the absolute sheer terror of having this earthquake so quickly after the May 12th. Any reports of casualties or building damage?
Well, not as far as we've heard so far today, but everywhere you go in Sichuan, you see, or in the earthquake zone, you see the evidence of the May 12th major earthquake. The roads have got huge craters in them where rocks tumbled down the mountainsides. The mountains have got chunks sheared away. And as I've been saying, there's so many people whose houses were crushed, whole towns, whole cities. 15 million people displaced, so many people bereaved, 100,000 people nearly either dead or missing, 10,000 of them children, and 5,000 children orphaned in the earthquake.
We talk about the bereaved parents of the children and how much angst and some protest there was against the Chinese government. Where is that story today as Beijing awaits the beginning of the Olympics next week?
Well, that story is nowhere in terms of the official media, because that story is one of the ones that has been blocked in China's domestic media. After the brief window of openness we saw at the time of the earthquake, the government's got very much back in control of the media message down here. Everyone must echo the theme that the government is doing the necessary, that they are competent, united, stable, that they're rising to the challenge of this enormous calamity. And stories about poor building, corruption of construction and local officials, those kinds of stories that some of the parents want to draw attention to are absolutely not welcome. The parents in question are getting threatened and in some cases detained.
Well, Carrie, you know, that begs the question. It appears that the Olympic opening ceremony is going to make reference to the tragedy that killed, as you said, 100,000 people. I'm wondering, given all of the sort of still very, very open wounds on the part of sectors of Chinese society that were so affected by this, Adora mentioned the parents of the children who were killed in the schools that were constructed so poorly, I'm wondering if the opening ceremony is going to feel a little like Berlin in the 30s as opposed to being an emotional touchstone for this really, really serious tragedy for the people of China.
Well, I think you see a situation where the majority of people here have only got one source of information, and they believe their government message. They are basically pretty grateful for what the government's done for them. Everything they lost has been lost in the earthquake, and the government's provided everything from toothbrushes to furniture, is going to give them these temporary homes and so on. So the majority of the people at this point are patient, dignified, fairly grateful. You do get small sectors like the parents in question who are angry and who want answers. But for the most part, people are looking forward to the Olympics. They're looking forward to the light relief of a little sport to take their minds off the misery in which they live.
Carrie, you spoke about that openness of the Chinese government. Now, there are many, many, many hundreds of journalists who are descending from all over the world. And one of the controversies this week was about how the Chinese government was trying to I was asking a question to Carrie Gracie, BBC correspondent in Chengdu, and I think we lost her. Tough line there. Anyhow, hopefully we'll speak to her again sometime. Now we're going to Femi Oke, because we're very flexible around here, for the latest headlines. Femi?
Thanks, Adora. Coming up to 22 minutes to the hour, flags in Minneapolis are flying at half-mast today to mark the first anniversary of the bridge collapse that killed 13 people and injured almost 150 others. A government scientist linked to the deadly 2001 anthrax attacks has committed suicide. According to the Los Angeles Times, the Justice Department was about to file criminal charges against 62-year-old Bruce Ivins of Maryland. Aid agencies in Afghanistan are warning they may not be able to continue to work there because of an alarming increase in violence. They say attacks are up 50% and 19 aid workers have been killed this year. Rescuers in central Turkey say they can hear voices underneath the rubble of a girl's dormitory that collapsed earlier today. Officials think a gas leak caused an explosion in the building. 13 people died and nearly 30 students have been injured. In Montana, fire crews are warning residents near Billings to get ready to evacuate again. Wildfire is threatening the homes and a nearby ski resort. Now, we were just talking about China. We're about a week away before the Olympics, starting on August the 8th officially. A couple of news stories coming in from China right now, all about the Olympics. A very rare press conference from President Hu Jintao, who's asked journalists to stay in China. They're very, very welcome, but doesn't want the event to be politicized. He says that raising any political issues at the Olympics won't actually solve them. And yesterday we had the story of internet sites being blocked at the Olympics. Journalists trying to use various internet sites couldn't get online. Now today, very subtly, Amnesty International is now available in China. So is the Human Rights Watch and the BBC Mandarin service. You won't find some cult services that China says you can't get into, but bit by bit, a little bit of the pressure is beginning to actually work.
What about TMZ? Can I bring up TMZ in Beijing?
I will ask.
I really want to know.
I could find out the answer for you.
What the journalists are going to really need.
Do you want me to use my time doing that this morning?
And there were also some reports I saw in some of the industry journalism newsletters who were saying that they were having no problems as long as you are not trying to log on from an official venue set up by the Chinese government. And we'll see how that unfolds.
There's a long tradition of the media sort of overemphasizing problems at the Olympics that never materialized. I remember Athens. You know, everything worked out just fine. Mm-hmm. We want to tee up the question that we asked at the top of the hour, and that is, who's the Mozart of today? If you are in the sort of music world and are thinking of a prodigy, a genius, someone on the order of Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart, please send us your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. We're going to be talking mostly Mozart a little bit later.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of home, auto, and life insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Time now for the latest headlines from Femi Oke. Hey there, Femi.
Hello there, Teodora. 12 minutes to the hour. General Motors has posted a $15.5 billion loss in the second quarter. That's the third largest quarterly loss in the company's history. The auto giant is chalking up some of those losses to the plummeting sales of trucks and SUVs. The New York Times says that the U.S. government has proof that the Pakistani spy agency helped militants attack the Indian embassy in Kabul earlier this month. Pakistan is angrily denying any connection with the bombing that killed 54 people. A 5.8 magnitude earthquake hit southwest China's Sichuan province today. That's the same area devastated by an earthquake in May that killed nearly 70,000 people and left 5 million homeless. There are no initial reports of casualties, but I will keep you up to date with that story. California's $15 billion deficit crisis has pitted Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger against the state legislature. The governor is laying off 22,000 state workers and slashing wages for 200,000 more in hopes that the drastic move will force lawmakers to agree on a spending plan. Not much to laugh about in the news today, apart from one story. Scholars in the UK have collected what they believe are the world's oldest jokes. They actually date back to 1900 BC. Here's one from 63 BC. See, I've got Terence's attention now. He's
caveman goes into a bar.
No. Okay, this is for 63 BC. That one's a little bit too early. Let me set it up for
very
you.
Quick.
Augustus was touring his empire and noticed a man in the crowd who bore a striking resemblance to himself. Intrigued, he asked, "Was your mother at one time in the service at the palace?" "No, Your Highness," he replied. "But my father was."
Oh, my goodness.
What was going on there? I missed that.
From 63 BC.
Okay, I feel...
That's a pretty good one.
Centuries right now. I feel the centuries.
That one
thank
was
you.
Funny.
Thank you, Femi. It was not bad. So... we talk about the Mozart at the top of the hour, and I just want to say, disclose personally, as you discover in your life who's the Mozart of the 21st century and send your story to us at 877-8-MY-TAKE, I want to disclose that I personally think Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart was one of the most annoying people in world history.
I'm a vulgar man, but I assure you my music is not.
He is divinely inspired. He is arrogant, vulgar, obscene.
He creates music for the gods.
He is passionate.
He burns with fire.
He is an angel.
He is a devil.
He is all of the above. That's from the movie Amadeus back in 1984. Mozart wrote operas by the time he was 13, concertos, sonatas, symphonies. Wolfgang Mozart was an absolute musical genius, and perhaps that's why I find him annoying. But to the rest of the world, he truly is a cultural icon. His music can be heard everywhere, especially at the Mostly Mozart Music Festival that's 42 years old this year here in New York. Terence McKnight, who's a music writer, blogger, and host of Evening Music on WNYC, is here with us. Terence, you've been actually broadcasting from the Mostly Mozart Festival, and in many ways the festival has evolved into finding not so much Mozart's themes and music in culture, but finding his creative spirit. How's that going?
Well, I mean, last year was the first year that the festival had a composer in residence, and a guy named Osvaldo Galeov was the composer in residence. This year they brought in another composer, a composer named Kaija Saariaho, and Louis Langrée has been the music director for 6 years now. Mm-hmm. And so they've started to expand and look at how Mozart influenced other composers through his philosophy, through his work, through his spirit. So it's a chance for them to bring other music into the tent of Mozart, of this Mostly Mozart
festival. So the composer in residence at the festival is actually exploring the spirit of Mozart. And here's some of the work that Kaija Saariaho actually presented at the festival. To embody Mozart's spirit, what do you think a composer has to do in this day and age?
I think a composer has to have a sense of humor, first of all.
Yep.
I mean, he has to have the composer has to have a real sense of technical proficiency as well, and be familiar with all of the music that's available. Mozart wrote in everything, every form that was available to him at his time. Not only did he write, but he wrote a masterpiece in opera and choral music and sacred music and concertos, every form that was available to him, he mastered it. So
you got to do it all. You got to do it all, and you got to push back on all the genres.
Who does that today?
That's a great question. I mean, who's able to write blues and hip hop and symphonies and oratorios and opera?
Would most deaf fit into that category?
Well,
he raps and he sings and he writes music and there's poetry and there's just, he exists on the continuum of music and
eclectic.
The arts.
You know, Frank Zappa had some of those qualities, but still kind of narrow.
Living today, Osvaldo Golijov, I think he was a great choice last year because he's delving to all of these, you know, different types of music. So, I mean, you know, Mozart did it in 35 years, so it's a tall order.
So annoying. Let's hear some of the contrasts that Mozart embodies in the Mostly Mozart Festival. Now, of course, the festival began with a performance of this very famous tune. Symphony number 40, the last movement. And here it is in a slightly different context. You can hear it in the background. There you go.
So, you really have to listen hard.
Well, but Mozart actually triggers in you the Mozart you've heard all your life. So even though it's in the background, it's in the foreground as far as your ears are concerned. That's EPMD sampling Mozart's 40th symphony there.
I mean, and if we're talking about hard times, which we were talking about earlier, about hard times, this guy composed this music towards the end of his life, Mozart did. He had just lost a daughter. He was in financial straits. He had to move. He didn't get his home foreclosed on, but he had to move out of his home into a small apartment in the suburbs. He was really going through some tough times.
And his life began as a prodigy, sort of traipsed around Europe by his kind of nutty dad to perform like a chimp on the violin and the piano. I mean, he was a child prodigy who had no chance to find a life outside of music. And so sometimes I listen to late Mozart and feel him like, you know, kind of like an Olympic gymnast. I wish I could go out and play. You sort of hear that in the music.
Yeah, well, you know, and then Mozart had to work for the aristocrats for most of his life. Mm-hmm. And then he became perhaps the first successful freelance artist. He left home, moved to Vienna, and tried to go off on his own and was successful until the war. There was a war in Austria, and so a lot of the money left the city, and so he struggled and had to beg for
But
beg
he
for
became
money.
The template, the model for Beethoven, for Brahms, for the independent artists who didn't rely on the aristocracy who
Absolutely.
Came after. Yeah, it's fascinating. So what do you think of the festival this year?
Festival got off to a wonderful start the other night with this theme of loss and transformation with Mozart and with Mahler, and lots of exciting music. There's Kaya's piece, The Passion. She's got a passion that's coming. There's a Requiem, so that dips back into some of Mozart's work. There's a lot of chamber music and solo piano music, you know, Schubert. Again, it's not all Mozart, but it's a lot of composers who tap into Mozart's reservoir of all of the music that he composed.
Mm. Was Mozart a celebrity in his day and age in the way that we understand it today?
For a while he was, yeah.
But only for a brief period. In many ways, his global significance is posthumous. It's after his death.
And that's what's so difficult about saying who the next Mozart will be.
Right.
We may have to wait a couple hundred years.
We may have to wait a couple hundred years.
Yeah. There's some perspective, yeah, thanks that, for that, that Terrence.
That would exceed the size of this segment, a couple hundred years. But Terrence, thanks so much for coming in.
You bet.
Terrence McKnight is a music writer and blogger and host of Evening Music on WNYC. Thanks so much for being here. We are always on here at The Takeaway. You can find us online, streaming at Friend Feed, on Facebook. Find our playlists at thetakeaway.org.
And, of course, we're still talking about the brink of a government shutdown, perhaps. Turkey's AK party narrowly missing being shut down themselves.
Loads of news out of China, another small earthquake in Sichuan province, and an eclipse that we didn't get to.
We were just talking Mozart, prodigy, genius, cultural insurgent. He's been called many things. Just don't call him Wolfgang in my presence. Who's your Mozart? 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
And there's an oil boom in North Dakota. Here's your takeaway.
Imagine that. The fate of the government is actually in the hands of people that lawmakers talk to.
That was Todd Zwillick talking about the breakout of democracy in Washington during the dog days of summer 2008. Todd Zwillick, of course, our man in Washington.
It's Friday. It's the first day of August, and I'm still a Dory Doji.
Ah, is that going to change anytime soon?
Well, I don't know. It could.
All right, stay
depending
tuned.
On circumstances.
Stay tuned. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.